These students, she decided, needed her. She looked out over their unreadable faces and got started with that day's prepared lesson on the Second World War. Almost immediately, the classroom became a place of indifference, with occasional spurts of anarchy. Some days, no one listened. She found herself begging them to listen, trying to bribe them. A couple of kids were outright menacing, including a large girl who said in an incongruously babyish voice, "I'm going to fuck you up," in response to a request to put down her pencil at the end of an exam, before immediately crying and apologizing. Always there were trips to the principal, and sometimes visits from Big Dave and security, who made things worse, escalating whatever in-room squall was taking place. Greer called and said, "Quit! Quit!" But Z, almost in tears, said, "I can't do that to them. I won't." Most days weren't about fear. They were about unbelievable frustration, even rage, her own. But she also felt nearly ill with sympathy over what her kids didn't have, didn't know, and couldn't do. One boy had the worst breath, and finally he shyly revealed that he didn't have a toothbrush or toothpaste and had no money to buy them. So she bought them for him. At Z's request, Greer sent cases of her parents' protein bars, and Z went out and bought packs of thick socks and gloves, always gloves. There was a sense that nothing did anything, that she was just another clueless person armed with supplies, throwing them into a volcano. And then one morning that spring, when Z was waiting for the train, a text came from Greer saying, "Are you available? It's an emergency." Soon they were on the phone, and Greer, in a guttural explosion, told her the most terrible news. Corey's little brother had been run over by his mother's car and killed. You didn't have to have met a child to know that his death was the worst thing you'd ever heard. At age 22, Z could imagine the death from the point of view of the child and the parent and the sibling all at the same time. Greer was sobbing, and Z wished she had something to say to her, some way to soothe her. But they were in different cities and lives now, so the best Z could do over the next few weeks was text her frequently saying, "How are you doing?" despite already knowing the answer. At lunchtime each day, after a rough or maddening morning, Z sat alone in the teacher's lounge, mostly listening to tales of other classroom experiences, small tragedies or tense near misses, or else anecdotes about bureaucratic stagnation and unrelated references to weekend activities such as online dating or bowling. She sometimes took special note of the guidance counselor, Noelle Williams, because she had been particularly unfriendly from the first day. She never spoke to Z at lunch, but sat in a small group of administrators, daintily eating a cup of yogurt, her plastic spoon knocking against the bottom and sides, her posture freakishly straight. When she was done eating, she put her trash into a neat little bundle, her hands practically compacting it. She never left traces of herself behind. Noelle Williams was 29 years old, her hair cut close to her head, revealing her skull's perfect, pleasing shape. Her delicate ears sprouted many tiny rings, and her outfits were immaculate, never creased. Z had always felt stylish in her own way, but Noelle's perfection was a reproach. One day at noon, Z nervily planted herself on the sagging couch beside the guidance counselor, whose lack of interest in getting to know Z was obvious, though this in itself made Z want to win her over. What had Z done to piss Noelle Williams off? Z asked her, "How long have you been working in Chicago?" The woman looked at her directly, appraisingly. 3 years, she said. "I was here at the inception of this school." "Oh, great. And before that I was getting my master's, and then working in a school out in the suburbs." "That must have been pretty different from this place." "Yes," said Noelle, and she didn't smile with bitter irony or add any details to show that while working here was unmanageable, they were both in it together, and the only way to try to manage it was to be ironic. She wasn't being ironic, nor was she welcoming. I'm just getting my feet wet, Z went on. Any tips about the teaching? It's hard to sustain anything in there.
Do I have any tips about how you should teach your classes? Asked Noel.
First of all, I'm not a teacher. But also, I imagine that you were given all the tips you need, were you not?
Were you not? Z almost mimicked her words back to her. What a cunt, she thought.
Well, I was given a crash course in teaching history, Z said. But teaching actual high school students is something else entirely, and teaching these kids, it's just barely happening. Too many crises, and too much tuning out. I get pretty despondent.
I understand.
Noel didn't say anything more. There was a moment of cool silence during which Z ate the sandwich she had sloppily made that morning in her tiny kitchen. Now the innards were falling out of the soft and floppy thing, a spill of dissonant ingredients that should never have been put together. Apple slices and a few whole baby carrots on their way out of this world, and a stiff Elizabethan ruffle of kale, all of it vaguely pasted together by a spackle of miso and a squirt of low-fat mayo from a squeeze bottle purchased at the bodega around the corner on the first lonely night she had moved to this city, knowing no one. Noelle watched as vegetables tumbled onto Z's lap, and was that actually a smile? A slightly unpleasant smile as she saw Z get slimed by her own lunch. Z dabbed at her shirt with a rough brown paper towel from the dispenser, leaving an oblong of oil behind. And when she looked up to say something else to Noelle, she saw that the door of the faculty lounge was pneumatically closing, and Noelle was already on her way to deal with some new problem. It might have gone on like this for quite a while, the guidance counselor being rude and unfriendly, and Z continuing to try to win her over. And perhaps one day Noelle would have said to her, Z, what are you doing? Why don't you stop? Can't you see I just don't like you? But instead, one afternoon, a month into the job, Z's student, Shara Pick, said, Miss Eisenstadt? Z was at the whiteboard creating a timeline that stretched from 1939 to 1945. A few people seemed very interested. One student in particular, Derek Johnson, knew everything about the war already and was contributing a lot to the discussion.
Yes, Z said.
Can I go to the bathroom?
Shara asked, and then she stood up and wobbled in front of her desk. She had to go, and she had to go now. She was a bumblebee-shaped white girl, and wherever she went, a cloud of chaos accompanied her. Crumpled sheets of paper, pens that leaked, little plastic microbeads from some unknown source. She was generally ignored in the class, seen as trashy and pitiable, and she didn't seem to fit in anywhere. During lunch, she sat alone, staring into the middle distance as she ate a bag of Doritos and called it a meal. Z had been informed by the assistant principal that Shara was considered at risk. Her parents were meth addicts, in and out of recovery, and she and her sisters had recently moved in with their kind but half-blind grandmother. The year before, the parents had both shown up for curriculum night, high out of their minds. It's a mess, Z had been told, and she had kept an eye out for Shara, who always wore a coat to class that had one of those Eskimo hoods that reminded Z of the cover of the old Paul Simon album that her parents had listened to during her childhood. Shara dozed frequently, which worried Z, who was on the lookout for signs of drug use in this vulnerable girl. But whenever there was an in-class essay, Shara would hunch down over her desk with her elbows and tongue out in a posture of deep, touchingly childlike concentration, and would turn out something that was surprisingly impassioned. Maybe there was a hidden interest there, a hidden possibility.
Sure, go, Z said. And she stayed at the whiteboard, writing up a list of factors that had led to war. She wrote and wrote so much in a tiny hand that the board appeared covered in wire mesh, though only some students were taking any of it down in their notebooks. Others were gazing out at her in comprehension or incomprehension or daydream, and a boy in front named Anthony was doodling extravagantly in his notebook, the detail work of skulls and devils impressive, if evidence of an extreme interest in Satanism that should probably be reported to the administration. A girl in the last row was doing her acrylic nails on top of her notebook, the strong smell wafting up toward the front of the room. The smell spread. The felt pen that Z dragged across the board uttered its occasionally shrill report, and the teenagers in the room shifted and settled and resettled. Someone howled like a wolf at length for laughs. The afternoon had a low blood sugar quality, with only 13 minutes left until class ended. Z would have had them write in their journals for a few minutes, and maybe let one of them play a song on the phone, which tended to focus the entire room. But then an awareness came over her, as strongly as the smell, that Shara hadn't returned from the bathroom. Z sent Taylor Clayton out to check on her, and while Taylor tended to be a hesitant girl, only moments later she banged back into the room, knocking against the doorframe and saying, "Something's wrong with Shara!" Shara was curled up on the floor of her stall in the bathroom, and somehow Z and Anthony, who'd been pressed into service, got her down to the nurse's office. "It hurts so bad," Shara was crying, and she held her stomach and rocked back and forth. The nurse, as it happened, was showing a drug film to another class, and only her aide sat at the desk in the small green room, putting tongue depressors into a jar one by one, thud, 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 and looking terrified when Shara was half carried and half dragged in and was then laid down on the bed. "I'll get Jean," the nurse's aide said as she ran from the room, scattering tongue depressors. "Tell him to leave too," Shara said, gesturing toward Anthony. The boy ran out, relieved, and then Z sat beside Shara, rubbing her arms and saying whatever she could think of. "It's probably appendicitis," she said, talking rapidly and idly. "My brother had that once. He screamed all night, but when they took it out, he felt better, and you will too. Did you know that the appendix serves absolutely no function?" she added, because she couldn't think of what else to say, and she wanted to distract Shara from her pain. "No," wept the girl. "Well, it's true." Then she became aware of someone hovering, and there above them was Noel Williams. "What's going on, Shara?" the guidance counselor asked in her calm voice.
"I'm sick."
"I think it's appendicitis," Z put in.
"And you know that from where? You're training at Harvard Medical School?" said Noel.
"Well,
or was that a unit at Teach and Reach?"
Z simmered but said nothing. It wasn't appropriate. This girl was suffering. Noel crouched down and opened Shara's coat, which was something that Z hadn't thought to do. The guidance counselor gently unzipped it and parted the two halves, revealing Shara Pick's full abdomen, astonishingly round, beneath her sweater. With the coat off, it was impossible to miss.
"May I raise your sweater?" Noel asked, and Shara nodded.
The skin of her abdomen was stretched and shining, the navel asserting itself like a pencil eraser, and below that was a bisecting dark stripe of skin, something called linea nigra, Z would learn later when she sat at her computer and looked up every single thing, every single moment, locked in studiousness the way Greer would have been if she'd been there for this. But armed with no knowledge yet, only instinct, in that moment in the nurse's office, Z and the guidance counselor looked at each other, alarmed, across Shara Pick. And then Noel said to Shara in a soft voice,
"Sweet Pea, did you know you were going to have a baby?"
"I thought, yeah, maybe I was."
"Well, you are. And Miss Eisenhower and I are going to help you."
Z didn't correct her. Everything happened so fast from that moment on. 911 was called. Shara made deep sounds in her throat, and she braced her legs and arched her back.
"I'll look up what to do," said Noel, and while Z encouraged Shara not to push, to keep her legs together, to wait, Noel sat at the nurse's desk. The nurse, Jean, why wasn't she back yet? On the old gum-colored Dell desktop computer, Noel punched in a password, and then success. She Googled the sparest and most economical collection of words she could think of. She was an excellent Googler, it would turn out.
Now, swiftly, Noelle located an online visual guide to delivering a baby in emergency circumstances with no training and no equipment. "Okay, I've got instructions here," she said. In a quiet and controlled voice, Noelle read, "What should I do to help someone in labor?" Somehow they managed to hold Shara off, to keep her from delivering a baby into their unschooled hands. Finally, Jean returned, followed immediately by the EMS team, a man and a woman, both young and competent, who raced in and took over. "Push, Shara," they told her after they had assessed the situation. And then the head emerged. The face emerged. And once that explicit sense of humanness appeared, it was as if everything else stopped. As soon as there was a face, everyone marveled. Same as a death. Everyone knew death existed, Z thought. Most people had known since childhood. The newspapers were filled with the tiny print of paid death notices and real obituaries, and sometimes one of Z's parents looked up from the paper while they drank their breakfast smoothies before heading to the courthouse and mildly said to the other something like, "Oh, did you see that Carl Sagan died?" Z thought of Cory Pinto's little brother. Gone. She thought of the faces of everyone she knew, trembling in the gelatin of their own temporariness. We're overwhelmed by faces, Z knew. The ones that leave and the ones that come. And she was overwhelmed by this one now. Suddenly, Z realized that something thick was wrapped around the baby's neck. It was the umbilical cord, looking like the bicycle cable with which Z had tied up her Schwinn all over the Ryland campus. She watched the paramedics carefully get it off. It was as if they were unlocking that bicycle chain in the rain, working the slippery thing with its intimations of something complex beneath the surface, out from among the spokes. The baby's head was sprung. "There we go, Shara," said the male paramedic tenderly.
"One more, Shara," echoed Jean, the nurse.
"You can do it," said Z. And then Noelle said, "You're doing great." Shara pushed heroically, and eventually there was a sound like a boot pressing into mud as the baby's shoulders rushed out, late for an important meeting, and the human face was revealed to be attached to a human body, genitals swollen and full and declaring, "Girl." Though they did not like each other, they were both in desperate, shaky need of decompression. So Noelle Williams and Z. Eisenstadt found themselves sitting together for a very early dinner in a nearby restaurant after the workday, which ended for both of them immediately after Shara's grandmother arrived, and everything was revealed to be stable, at least medically. Z tried to go to the hospital with her frightened student, but Jean, the nurse, said no, she would go instead. There was nothing more for Z and Noelle to do. Noelle chose a small soul food restaurant called Miss Marie's with wood paneling and an excellent soundtrack featuring Smokey Robinson and the Miracles. A tin bowl of pickled green tomatoes was placed on the table, and Z sliced one hard, feeling the give of the skin, knowing that even though her knife was dull, she could cut this. She had nearly delivered a baby today, after all. The baby of a baby. Poor Shara Pick, she thought. Poor baby girl Pick. There was nothing she could do for her students but buy toothbrushes and tube socks and assist at a delivery and feel a constant sadness or anger or fear. "What's going to happen?" she asked. "Her family is such a mess." "Oh, I know. It's as sad as it gets," said Noelle. "Her parents came to school once and they could barely stand up. I don't know what they're like now. The social worker is heading over to the hospital tonight and we'll follow up tomorrow, but it's all very bleak."
"Will she be allowed to come back to school?"
"Sure, there are various options, but I have no idea what she's going to do. We have a program for mothers, but honestly, it all kills me. Why did no one see that that girl was pregnant?" "Oh, that was a rhetorical question. It's a question that will be put to the entire faculty and staff when we meet next. And I'm going to suggest we have an emergency meeting, because none of us noticed it.
We can't just say she was carrying small, though clearly she was. That baby was like a hand puppet. And yet the EMS team said she was fine. Small but fine. Her lungs sounded good. I feel terrible that I missed it. But I couldn't see anything. Shara wore a parka to class every day, said Z. That in itself was a warning sign. I didn't know that. Of course you didn't. At which point Z wondered how much shit she was meant to take from the guidance counselor. Why did Noelle dislike her with such ferocity, even after everything they had done together today, and the raw drama of it? What did I ever do to you, Noelle? She asked. The waitress appeared then, cutting off the confrontation, so they ordered dully from the menu. Chicken for Noelle, a vegetable medley for Z. When you were a vegetarian, your restaurant meals were heavy on medleys. Then Noelle looked up at her with an expression that was surprisingly not hostile. Z, she said, it's not you. Well, it is you. It's your trusting nature, your idealism. I wasn't under the impression that those were bad qualities. Z swirled the beer in her glass and suddenly had a surge of desire to be drinking beers with Greer instead of with this unfriendly woman. Everyone said Chicago was such a great city. The Art Institute, they exclaimed. The nightlife, the music, the lake. But Z had seen very little and done very little, because it was hard to love a city when you were entirely alone in it. Or at least hard for Z. Maybe she could convince Greer to come visit some weekend. Together, they could go down to the edge of the shining lake and throw stones and talk about what was painful in their lives and what was hopeful. But the unfriendly woman here had a command over Z. It wasn't deserved, but it was real. Noelle, she noted, had a sexy throat. They aren't bad qualities in a vacuum, Noelle conceded. But when my kids get used, I consider those qualities less than helpful. Your kids, said Z. They're not my kids now, too? You think of your students as your kids? Why shouldn't I? You know something? I deserve some slack from you, Z said. I'm new, I'm muddling through, and I just went through a thing today. I joined Teach and Reach to do some good, I really did. And if that's not happening, well, I don't know what else to do. But ever since I came to this school, you've hated me. You think this is about you? Noelle said. You are just a cog in the Teach and Reach wheel, so please don't inflate your position. I know we've had a rough day, and we've had it together, but if I hated you, I would not be sitting with you right now. I would be far away from you. Oh, so you're saying you like me? That's puzzling. It sure doesn't come off as liking. You're going to have to work harder if you want me to like you. But it sounds a little more possible than your other goal, said Noelle. Saving the students in the Learning Octagon Network. They need all the help they can get. Not from you, sweet pea. This was almost murmured, the same endearment Noelle had used with Shara during the delivery, and she had meant it tenderly then, but now she meant it sharply, lovelessly. Then from who? Who else can help an octagon made up of only 7 schools, where everyone starts off with nothing? I acknowledge my privilege. I grew up in Scarsdale, New York. But why should my class background disqualify me? Does my experience have to be the same as my students? My mother is a solidly middle-class office manager for an allergist here in Chicago, said Noelle. She raised my sister and me all by herself. My father died of a heart attack when I was 5. But we had everything we needed, just like you. Music lessons, orthodontia, lots of books on the shelves, and a life of consistency. That is my mother's strong suit. I'm not saying that anyone's experience has to be the same as the students. So what are you saying? Noelle leaned closer across the table. From this sudden proximity, Z was given a different view. She didn't simply have to be intimidated by her or admire her physically. As for the possibility of being betrayed, this had nothing to do with the older women in Z's past, Linda Mariani and Dr. Marjorie Albrecht, who had both shockingly betrayed her, or even Faith Frank,
who hadn't betrayed her but had simply had no interest in hiring her, despite Z's heartfelt letter. Noelle Williams had given her no expectations at all. Z didn't have to be hurt by her. She could stand up to her if she chose. "We were told," said Noelle, "that a dedicated team of teachers would sweep in on their dedicated horses and they would save our schools. But in fact, what's happened is that a team of completely unprepared teachers, right out of college themselves, and with virtually no training except for a crash course that is far shorter than the course you'd need to take in order to become an air conditioning repair person, have been sent into our schools. And we're told to be grateful. We're told that this is good enough, and that we should be respectful of the notion that people like you are willing to accept a low-paying job in order to do something worthwhile. When in fact, no, it is not good enough, at least not to me. Some of my colleagues feel differently from me. They approve of Teach and Reach, and think it's an admirable enterprise that's worthy of our support. But since Teach and Reach came, it's worth pointing out that things are no different. Now, I am comforted by our president, a black man, and brilliant and kind. I just love him to pieces. But nothing is going to change the baked-in bad stuff all that fast. And in various ways, Teach and Reach is just making everything worse. It can't take any criticism, and therefore it will never change. And all it keeps doing is trying to squeeze our schools to fit into some corporate-driven shape. Veteran teachers are being laid off, but Teach and Reach keeps going. It degrades the profession of teaching. And of course this program is targeting black and brown communities. It would never fly in a white school. And you know what's going to happen? There are forces out there that are lying in wait, taking their time, knowing they will have their moment. You and some of the others, you're not bad people. I know that. But you're not skilled, and you're not prepared, and you're only doing these jobs for a little while. You're not here for the duration. No one even thinks you are. You're here post-college to try and do something good. And once you've had that experience, you're going to turn around and do something else. Probably something less good, but more financially rewarding. I don't blame you, Z. I'd do it too if I were you. But we need people who are here for the long run, because things are going to get so much worse. And then what will happen?
So, you're saying I should quit now?
Noelle looked at her steadily. Is that really what you think? No, of course I'm not saying that. You shouldn't do that to these kids, not in the middle of the year, not like some people. They crave stability. You stay, and you finish the year, and you do your best, and then you decide. Look, I'm sure you're a fine person. And I'm sure you're a person who is trying hard to, what do you say to yourself, get involved? I know that feeling. I have had it myself. But sometimes the way to get involved is to just live your life and be yourself with all your values intact. And by just being you, it'll happen. Maybe not in big ways, but it'll happen.
I saw it differently, Z said quietly. Noelle nodded. In any event, it happened really fast. I was living with my parents and working as a paralegal. I really hated it. My best friend works for Faith Frank. She has a women's foundation, and I thought maybe I could work there too, but that didn't happen. I had to get out of the law firm, not to mention my parents' house. But Judge Wendy Eisenstadt made it very clear that whatever I did, I needed to make a living wage.
Who?
My mother.
You call her Judge Wendy Eisenstadt?
Yes, or Judge Wendy. It drives her crazy. She prefers Mom. But honestly, she's had such a judicial presence my entire life. When she shows up in my dreams, sometimes she's wearing robes. My dad, too. He's the other Judge Eisenstadt, but he's more low-key.
Noelle smiled. Was it the first smile? At least it was the first unambivalent one.
So, I guess, she said, your name isn't Eisenhower.
No.
And yet you didn't correct me.
I wouldn't do that. It might make you self-conscious.
Do you correct your students when they say something wrong? Asked Noelle.
Yes, Teach and Reach tells us we're supposed to. Do you always do what everyone tells you? If they ask nicely. Well, I'll have to learn to ask you to do things nicely, then, said Noelle. Note to self.
Z paused, trying to figure out this turn.
That would be a good idea. You might even see some results, she finally said. Better than test scores. No woman left behind.
There was an open playfulness between them now. They'd gone from friction to childbirth to an angry soliloquy to this new, uncertain stage.
I'm so confused, Z thought, looking at Noelle's small, ornamented ear.
Is your mother very maternal? Z suddenly wanted to know.
Medium. She's more like the steward of a ship. A nice ship, though. Yours?
She's been good at what she does. I can't complain. Seeing Shara today, I was thinking that she's just entering that whole parade, isn't she?
What parade?
Oh, a mother begetting a tiny potential mother. She wasn't even sure she was going to have a baby, said Z. She poked around at her plate.
I can't even imagine, she added.
What, having a baby?
Right, yeah. My body, all of this equipment that I possess. I've never spent a lot of time thinking of it as reproductive. I had a movement therapist when I was a teenager who apparently thought I was denying my womanhood, but I wasn't. I never have. I like being a girl. I just want to be the one who says what that means. My idea of hell would be to suddenly give birth without knowing it was going to happen.
That's anyone's idea of hell.
Suddenly, urgently, Z asked, will we definitely find out what happens to Shara and her baby? Can we go see her? And if she doesn't come back to school, is this going to be the last we'll hear?
I'll make sure we hear, and that we find a way to help her if we can. I will try not to let her slip through the cracks.
She's a mess, but she likes history. She's good with dates, said Z.
Maybe this was an exaggeration, but she wanted to say it. Someone had to stand up for Shara Pick, to declare her worthwhile as more than the carrier of a baby that she might soon turn over to someone else's arms, and as more than a collection of uncontrollable parts.
She must have been so scared, said Z.
The body did not always do what you asked it to. It had its own ideas, its own trajectory. Even now she thought that her own body was like a tuning fork that was responding to Noelle's very particular pitch.
You look scared.
Z looked up.
It was very scary. Very shocking.
I don't mean that. I mean now, Noelle said in a constricted, nearly formal voice. Because of me.
Okay, Z admitted. You can be a little scary.
Is that all I am to you? A scary person?
Z took her time, trying to make sure she was understanding what was happening, the new voice Noelle was using, and what it meant. There was a familiar feeling here. Noelle had to be aware of it, too.
Think, think, Z thought, wondering if she had missed an interpretation. Nothing else occurred to her. Crisis usually abated to reveal calm, but this one was revealing another, different kind of crisis.
No, Z said. Not only.
Then what else?
This was said as a direct challenge. All Z would say was, this is weird.
You don't like it?
I don't know what it is.
Are you sure you don't?
Okay, I guess I do, said Z.
Is it okay, then?
Asked Noelle, and Z nodded. Neither of them knew what to say next. They went back to the business of eating dinner, and they drank their cold beers and shared a banana pudding for dessert, both spoons dipping into the same beige mass, reminding Z of watching Noelle in the faculty lounge eating a cup of yogurt, which made that little galloping hooves on plastic knock-knock sound.
It was the sound of a self-contained woman eating the international symbol of female food, yogurt. Women with their calcium needs. You could go so many places in the world and find women eating yogurt.
"Want to get the check?" asked Noelle.
She waved an arm around for the waitress. She was a little drunk, Z realized, and she felt worried that perhaps Noelle's low-level drunkenness was the cause of her apparent interest in Z. Maybe Noelle had been tricked into flirting only by virtue of the beer, and later she would be horrified with herself. Because after all, maybe she was a guidance counselor at a charter school who was as straight as the day is long.
"You're tipsy," Z said.
"That's why you're being this way? 3 beers?
"No," Noelle said. "I deliberately had that 3rd beer because I was starting to be this way."
"This way?
Attracted to you?"
"Oh."
Noelle drew a finger down the side of the beer glass, bisecting the condensation. Why was it that the words "attracted to you" were like lightning? It slayed Z that Noelle Williams, the imperious guidance counselor, an older African-American woman with an impossibly elegant bearing, was attracted to her.
"Okay, then," said Z, and they both laughed.
And how strange, too, that laughter would characterize so much of what they did from that night on, even if some of it was the laughter of helplessness in the face of what was unfixable. There were other bad things that happened at the school. A boy beaten so severely on his way home that his eye popped from its socket. Another teach-and-reach faculty member giving up the ship. A broken boiler that rendered the school uninhabitable for 2 days. But on the night after Shara's baby was born, they walked from the restaurant out into the suddenly blowing snow, spring snow, because this was Chicago, onto a quiet street and got on the train, which took them mostly in silence and fluorescence toward Z's 6 flat, because it was closer than Noelle's place, which was a good 40-minute ride, and in 40 minutes, the spell might well have been broken. Thank God the place was clean, Z thought, as she threw on the lights.
"Student-y," Noelle declared,
and Z saw the room as Noelle saw it. The sofa that was covered with a generic Indian print fabric. The small framed flyer on the wall, advertising a college speech in the chapel several years earlier, given by Faith Frank. The clementines in a blue bowl. The photo of Z and another woman, clearly her good friend, in graduation gowns. The new life that Z. Eisenstadt was trying to settle into here in Chicago.
"Yeah, I can't help it," Z said. "I was a student for so long that it's the only way I know how to be."
"I remember all this," said Noelle, who then decisively brought Z toward her by the shoulders, which was as much a relief as it was a thrill. They kissed for a long, leisurely time. When they lay down on the narrow mattress that Z had purchased at a garage sale upon moving here, and had carried on her own back like a Sherpa the 7 blocks home, she couldn't help but think a little bit about power. Who had it right now? The older woman or the younger one? Power was hard to understand sometimes. You could not quantify it or calibrate it. You could barely see it, even when you were looking straight at it.
"That's what everyone was talking about at the first Loci Summit," Greer had said recently on the phone when the subject came up. "The meaning and uses of power."
"The summit you missed because of Corey's brother."
"Yeah, but everyone who was there, the rest of our team, said that it was clear that it's a topic we're going to return to, because no one can get enough of it. It excites everyone. Power. Even the word is powerful."
"Right," said Z. "It has the word pow in it, like in a comic book." To live in a world of female power, mutual power, felt like a desirable dream to Z. Having power meant that the world was like a pasture with the gate left open, and that there was nothing stopping you, and you could run and run. Noelle looked formidable with or without her clothes, though of course without them she was more vulnerable to Z's impressions of her. Their hands were on each other, on Z with her curated boyish look, and Noelle with her carefully feminine look, that was slightly tempered by the nearly shaved head and prominent hip bones and the careful comportment, giving her the quality of one of those artists' mannequins. The arms and legs could be rearranged any way you liked, link by link. And this was what sex was, too, when power was fluid. You could rearrange the other person, and they could rearrange you. Now the snow fell steadily, and after a long, expressive round of new-person sex, the two women finally settled themselves in for the night. Power had been there a moment ago, but now it wasn't. How strange that Z had just been thinking about it, and suddenly it was irrelevant. The day had been impossibly long and difficult, and all that she needed to do now was collapse. "Sweet pea," Noelle called her before they slept, in a third and entirely different use of that term of endearment. Part 3. I Get to Decide. Chapter 8. The red awning above the storefront read Qigong Tui Na Relaxing, Invigorating, Unforgettable Massage. Words that did not register as interesting to most New Yorkers passing this street corner in the West 90s on a mild night in the fall of 2014. But Faith Frank knew their significance, and once a week after work, she had the car and driver take her there, for she just loved a good Chinese massage. She felt, simply, that these bracing, almost disconcertingly vigorous massages helped her marshal her thoughts and make good decisions and stay calm and dispense advice to all the people who came to her for it. She had discovered this one day, 2 years earlier, when she'd had a bad stiff neck, and in desperation on the way home from work, she'd asked her driver, Morris, her contract with Losai had included the use of a driver and car, to stop there. As Faith lay on a table in this dim establishment, with her face in a cushioned cradle and a small woman working an elbow into the base of Faith's spine, ideas began to jump out of her as if sprung from captivity. So now here she was again on this night with another stiff neck. She'd been all checked out by her internist and found to be in good health, but the body still needed fine-tuning at this age. As Faith approached the staircase to enter the establishment, her cell phone softly pulsed against her breast like a companion heart, and she reached into her coat. "Lincoln," read the display. "Oh, hey, honey," she said, invigorated in the way that she always felt when he called. "Hey, Mom." The voice of her son, Lincoln Frank Landau, had been cautious since childhood, as if he was afraid to expect too much from life. "You're in the middle of something?" he asked. The answer was always yes, not that she always told him that. "Well, I'm about to be, getting a Chinese massage in a minute." "Your neck is tight again?" he said. "Mom, you should slow down. All that travel is bad for you." "Oh, my schedule's not so bad." "I actually don't believe you. I saw on your website calendar that you have that Hollywood event coming up. And I saw who was going to be there. Jesus!" "No, Jesus is not going to be there, Link, and we couldn't afford him." "Well, it's still a far cry from what you used to have at Losai in the beginning. Female sea captains." Faith laughed. "Well, Schrader Capital told us we needed to go high profile. Everything is about branding, they say, which of course is a despicable thing, because it really means everything is about corporations. But here we are in the America of today. So now, yes, we have the female action star of Gravitas 2, The Awakening. And did you read about the feminist psychic who's been hired to entertain between talks?" "No." "Oh, it's such bullshit," Faith said. "I imagine her standing before a huge group of women, closing her eyes and saying in this really spooky voice, 'One day, you will stop menstruating.'" Lincoln laughed easily. "Plus complimentary manicures, right? And all that foodie type of food. I saw a picture on Instagram recently. What were you serving?" he asked. "It was really exotic. Maybe pelican butter?" Faith laughed too and said, "Something like that." But the subject of the excesses of the foundation 4 years in was actually depressing to her. Over the past 2 years in particular, the Foundation had been relentlessly urged in this direction by an increasingly vocal presence at Schrader Capital. I keep telling Emmett that rich women attending conferences with massages and wonderful food doesn't get at anything, she said to Lincoln, that it doesn't grapple with structural issues like parental leave, childcare, equal pay. It doesn't put hands on levers. And yet, as he kindly reminded me, we have to grow. And they've been generous. As she talked, she began to mount the stairs in the narrow, dark hallway. Distantly, a thin Chinese version of Muzak could be heard. They've agreed to some things that they have no interest in, she went on, though fewer and fewer over time. But I think I told you about the rescue mission we funded recently, one of those special projects we sometimes do. I had to fight for this one. They're getting so infrequent. Ecuador, right? Yes, the young women who were saved from trafficking, 100 of them. And then they were hooked up with female mentors. Don't say hooked up, Mom. It sounds like you mean something else. Good point, said Faith. But you get the idea. We connected them with women who taught them a trade. So sure, we may have a psychic and mani-pedis and fancy lunches with pelican butter, but we also have missions like this one. So maybe it evens out. Maybe, he said. Actually, Faith said, one of the rescued young women is flying in for that L.A. event, and I'm supposed to introduce her. Is it essential that you do it? Your neck, your exhaustion? Lincoln, I love you with all my heart, but please don't tell me what to do. I try not to tell you what to do. There was a churlish silence, and she wanted to break it fast, so she said, So, how's the tax code? Still kicking. And still shockingly unfair? Depends on your bracket, he said. This last part was a kind of vaudeville routine that they had been amusing only themselves with over the years since he'd become a tax lawyer. Lincoln was 38 now and lived in Denver. Unmarried, dedicated, he resembled his father, Jerry Landau, an immigration advocate to whom Faith had been married only for several years until his shocking death at exactly the age Lincoln was now. Jerry had been a pale, mild man who looked hamsterish with his aviator glasses off. With them on, he looked more himself, thoughtful, brainy, distracted. She'd liked him right away. The first time he took Faith anywhere in his car, an old yellow Dodge Dart, he'd had to clear so many papers and books and a bag of bagels off the passenger seat in order for her to sit down that it was comical. When you went to anti-war meetings, she asked Jerry, did you speak up a lot? Are you kidding? He said. Those guys wouldn't let me get a word in, and when I did speak, they interrupted. Same, she said. Lincoln now looked like Jerry then, but much squarer in style, and with less hair. Already her son's hair had fled his head, as if pushed away by the complexities of the tax code. She still hoped he would fall in love, her reserved and mild son. As a boy, Lincoln had always been resourceful and independent. But after Jerry's sudden heart attack and death, Lincoln drew into himself and wouldn't discuss it, preferring to act as though it hadn't happened. Faith ached for Lincoln much more than for herself. She knew she would never marry again, would never give him another father. She was a loving, busy mother, distracted by her demanding work at Bloomer and her political activity and all the interviews she was asked to give back then. She rarely cooked, except for the occasional steak. Once, when he was 10, Lincoln had screamed at her, "Why can't you be like other mothers?" "What do you mean?" she asked. "Why do I have to have Mrs. Smith?" "I'm sorry, I don't know what you..." "Why do I have to have Sara Lee?" he asked, a little hysterical. She'd said, "What? Who are those women?" But then immediately she realized. "Oh, Lincoln, I am who I am," she'd said. "I'm who you got, and I try to be the best I can." "Try harder!" he yelled. She tried harder, but as he grew, they were so different. Lincoln was serious, steadfast, methodical, and liked things to be a certain way and a certain way only. Having a prominent feminist as a mother had made him neither wildly political himself nor a misogynist. Once, when he was a teenager and some reporter had asked him if he was a feminist, he'd said, "Well, obviously," offended at the question. But that was the extent of it. He was conventional, reserved, yet their love was mutual, established, sometimes distracted, and never in doubt. She missed his young, vulnerable, ownable self. You never knew when you were lifting your child for the last time. It might seem like just a regular time when it was taking place, but later, looking back, it would turn out to have been the last. Lincoln's increasing lack of neediness was hard for Faith sometimes, but it was also something of a relief to think that he was all right on his own. In this way, they were actually alike. "Now, tell me what's going on with you," she said to him.
"Another time. Go have your massage, Mom."
She watched the phone go dark, then held it in her hand for a few more seconds. It was the closest she could get these days to holding Lincoln himself. Faith pushed through the glass door of the massage place and entered the anteroom where young Chinese women sat on a sofa waiting for their appointments and walk-ins. One of the women stood and nodded, and Faith nodded back.
"You want 30, 60, or 90 minutes?" the woman asked.
And Faith said, 60.
Then, with no further comment, she was led down a long, unlit hall. From inside the curtained cubicles came the sounds of flesh being battered by hands. The masseuse, whose name was Sue, started on her through the towel, working along the spine and shoulders and neck. Oh, the neck, all of which were desperate for attention. The long strokes down the length of the back, punctuated by occasional sharp pokes, dropped Faith stupefied into a hole, as if the face cradle were a tunnel and she was going down inside it, to the place where everything waited that had come before. They were twins, having shared a uterus and then, later on, a bedroom. That bedroom, on West 8th Street in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, wasn't much bigger than the uterus had been, relative to their growing bodies. And so a red gingham curtain hung from a rod dividing the two halves, providing what passed for privacy in that household. At night, though, lying in their separate curtained compartments, neither of them really wanted privacy. They just wanted to talk. They were born 6 minutes apart in the winter of 1943, wartime, Faith first and then Philip, and their differences were obvious to everyone. She was the student, the serious one, beautiful but remote. He was more popular and sunny and accessible. She worked harder, and he slid by on slapdash charm and athletics. At night, through the curtain, Faith and Philip asked each other advice about dating.
"Well, the first thing I would say is don't date Owen Lansky," Philip said. "He will definitely want to go all the way."
She was touched by his protectiveness, and he was proved right about Owen Lansky, who was extremely pushy and had a head of oiled hair that, if you were locked in an embrace with him, would leave your face shining wet. They often talked so late into the night that their mother sometimes appeared in the doorway in her robe and said,
"You two, go to bed."
"We're just talking, Mom," said Philip. "We have a lot to say."
"What do I need to do to get you to sleep?" she asked. "Do I have to hit you over the head with a frying pan?"
"Save your frying pan for breakfast," Faith said. "Good night, Mom."
As soon as their mother left, Faith and Philip returned to their fevered and intimate conversation. It wasn't just brother and sister who were close. The entire Frank family made up a kind of four-person team. They had boisterous dinners, and they played charades. All four of them were crack players. When guests came over for the evening, they were asked, "Do you want to play charades?" And if the answer was no, they were rarely invited back. Throughout the twins' childhood, their overworked housewife mother, Sylvia, and tolerant, easily amused Taylor father, Martin, were encouraging to both of them. They were made to feel as if what they did, the path they were on, their whole way of being in the world was good enough. Their childhood was happy, and the transition into adulthood was meant to be happy too. But one night, their parents said they needed to have a family discussion.
"Let's all sit in the living room," said Martin.
Sylvia sat beside him. It was unusual to see her just sitting there, not fussing around or pulling something out of the oven. Philip pointed to Faith.
"She did it, not me. It was all her. I had nothing to do with it."
Faith rolled her eyes.
"Here's the situation," said Martin. "You know, you're not the only ones in this house who stay up late talking. We do, too. And one conversation we've been having late at night is about your education. We're both so proud of you. But as your parents, we worry."
"What are you getting at?" Faith asked. She had a sense almost immediately that this was about her. "Every day there are terrible stories in the newspaper," said Sylvia.
"We used to live in a safe country," said Martin. "But just last week in the paper, I read about a man who hurt a girl on a college campus. She was walking back to her dormitory late at night. We don't want you to find yourself in a situation like that, Faith. I don't think we could bear it."
"I'll walk places with friends at college," said Faith. "Twos and threes, I promise."
"It's not just that," said Sylvia.
Then she looked at Martin, both of them unbearably uneasy.
"Sex," Martin finally said, looking down. "There's that to think about, honey."
"Oh, don't worry," Faith thought. "I'll definitely do that in twos."
"There will be pressures on you," said her father. "You've been very sheltered up until now, and I'm afraid you don't know what college men might want and expect."
For more than a year, Faith had been quietly thinking about going away to college to study a subject like sociology or political science or anthropology. She had mentioned college once in a while, and neither of her parents had given her a sense that they wouldn't let her leave home and go away to school. Though they had been surprisingly vague about the subject, she had somehow trusted that when the time came, it would all work out.
"Please don't do this to me," she said. For she wanted exactly what her parents feared. She saw herself studying, but then putting down the book to embrace a man who would embrace her back.
"I'm a good student," she tried, her voice catching.
"Yes, you are. And we want to protect you. We want you to live at home," said her father. "There are excellent schools in the city."
"What about Philip?" Faith asked. "Philip will go away to school," her father said easily. Faith glanced at her brother, who looked away.
"It will be good for him. Look," he went on, "you're different people, and you need different things."
Faith stood up as if somehow towering over her sitting parents would help her cause.
"I don't want to live at home," she said. She turned to her brother. "Tell them you agree with me," she said to him.
"I don't know, Faith," he said. "I think I should just stay out of it."
That night in bed, Faith cried so hard that Philip pushed aside the curtain with a screech along the rod and appeared in her side of the room in the street lamp light. He wasn't just her brother now. He was a male going off into the world.
"Look, our folks are great," he said. "We couldn't have asked for a happier family.
They're kind of old-fashioned, but maybe they're not totally wrong. You'll get a good education. We both will."
They were never particularly close after that. When he went off to the University of Minnesota, he wrote her letters describing the different clubs he had joined, and as an afterthought, the classes he was taking.
"This girl I'm dating, Sadell, she helps me study," he said. "She's a smart one. Not as smart as you, though," he felt he needed to add.
Later on, even into middle age and after, they still spoke every year on their shared birthday, though Philip was always the one to call her, never the other way around. Faith just didn't ever feel compelled to pick up the phone and speak to him. He had gone away to college, but had never become very intellectual. He'd once proudly told her that the last book he'd read was called Chicken Soup for the Realtor's Soul. They had nothing in common anymore, except a birthday. Faith, forced to live at home when she went to school, became a sociology major at Brooklyn College, and she loved her classes, especially the ones where everyone got to talk. She found herself accepting offers of dates from boys she met at school, though always her mother or father stayed up and made sure she got home by her Cinderella curfew. It was maddening to see one of them waiting up in the living room.